we've covered, or indeed go and throw us some feedback from the C-Box, you can go and visit bookarmor.com. That's bookarmor.com. You can go and see some of the stuff we've talked about in the past shows, and also there's a C-Box there where you can post comments and feedback, or indeed any questions that you have relating to what we're talking about at the moment. So we'll just get that out of the way. So there's the plug for the interaction parts. So, Jay?
Just need to scroll down for the C-Box.
Ah, yes. Good, yeah, good point. So, Jason, your week in Taiwan, how's it been?
Well, last week, people that listen to the show will know, I went for a trip to the hospital to enjoy the Taiwanese health service, and we talked about that. And this week, I went back again to have another talk with them. But it was a very interesting appointment, if you want to hear something about that.
Okay, we're going to explain. The intrigue.
The intrigue is, 5 years ago, I went to this same department. Perhaps it was a different doctor, different man in a white coat. And on that occasion, they did some tests and brought me back and told me that I had two diseases. One of them was a form of arthritis, and the other was this very nasty degenerative disease called, let me get it right, alkalosis spondylitis. It sounds like a Greek pop star from the 70s, I think my mum was into him.
Excellent. Baritone.
Yeah, well, this alkalosis spondylitis is a degenerative disease of the spine. It's also it's kind of similar to an arthritis. So that was 5 years ago. They did a test on my DNA, and they said, the doctor said, yeah, you have the gene for this particular disease. And, you know, I said to him on that occasion lightheartedly, I said, will this ruin my life? He said, oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, it will. And then he waved me on my way. I went back this time after a five-year interlude. Because I thought if they did some more tests, they'd be able to establish, you know, the progress of these, in quotes, diseases. And on Monday, they informed me, a different doctor, that actually there were no signs of either disease. Rather surprised.
Yeah,
by this
news. How's that possible? I mean, how can you be diagnosed with two serious illnesses and then obviously the next time you go back? I mean, I take it they did the same tests again.
What this doctor said was the gouty arthritis, there were none of the needle crystals, the needle-like crystals that form in the blood and that cause all the pain. I have had one of these crystals. Anyone listening that has gout and has it severely, you know, they have my total sympathy. I've only had one crystal break in my toe, and it just feels like stepping on a needle. So perhaps just lifestyle changes have driven it down to sort of non-existent levels. The spondylitis one, the doctor made the point that although I have the gene, doesn't mean I have the disease. And the doctor should have actually, the proof of having the disease is the evidence, is the symptoms, not the DNA test. So he said 5 years later, looking at the x-rays, there's no sign. So you don't actually have, or so far, have developed this disease. So he said, just come back and we'll watch. The point being, as we've kind of talked about on this show, the nature of the kinds of things we're told in a complicated modern society is you do have to take people on trust. It's just impossible to know everything about everything, or even everything about any one thing. So 5 years ago, I did, perhaps unwisely, kind of go with what they told me. And then 5 years later, there's another doctor telling me none of it's true. He could be wrong too. Maybe everyone's wrong. But it's been a lot of stress for the last 5 years. And then, you know, my world was turned upside down once, and then it's turned upside down again. So that was my strange encounter with the Taiwanese health service. So I guess I just have to carry on afterwards.
Well, I mean, had you, over the last 5 years where you've been told you had these illnesses, had you been kind of, had some people use their illness to kind of identify themselves with, you know, so had you kind of got used to changing your life around these illnesses, or hadn't it really made an impact that much, or what?
Well, I hadn't become one of these illness bores or illness nerds that researches their illness in depth and has got nothing better to talk about, or wishes to encounter fellow sufferers to sit around to eat, break digestive biscuits with and complain to one another. So no, I didn't really feel that way. The thing it made a difference to was that I forewent various things that I might have enjoyed doing previously, like playing tennis or being riding bicycles or just being kind of anything that was kind of too active. Anything more active than walking, I've basically not engaged in, just because I thought it wasn't necessarily a good idea to be throwing my skeleton around if I've got this degenerative disease of the skeleton. And that was about the sum of it. With the gout, I didn't drink any alcohol anyway, so I didn't really have anything to give up. I'm not Oliver Reed. So it was okay. But I did feel the one thing I was really glad about was that they always kept telling me even last week when he wasn't so sure that he hadn't got the results back. You know, that doctors love to tell you to go swimming for whatever kind of ailment you have. I don't know why. I don't know if they own shares in swimming pools. But I'm really grateful that I never went swimming, because it's one of the things I dislike the most. There's a very interesting story today, a Canadian study. They've calculated how many liters of urine deposited in a pool there. They've kind of studied this. There are preservatives in food, in processed food, that the body doesn't really do anything to break them down, and they just emerge from the body in the same concentration as they went in. So they measured this substance in the swimming pools there to make a determination, and they said there were 75 liters of urine in this swimming pool, and basically it's fairly disgusting.
That's, yeah, grim.
The urine is sterile, but there are kinds of, you know, people have got all kinds of stuff in their urine, and it can react with the chemicals in the pool and form these I don't know what they would be. They can form another substance which, if you breathe it in or you're having contact with it, can irritate your eyes or even give you asthma if you're swimming too much. So my main source of gratitude was that I didn't listen to their advice and turn myself into the man from Atlantis over the last 5 years. So I spared myself all that.
Foregoing the webbed feet and webbed fingers. That's a shame.
I'm really showing how old I am already, I think, with these references.
Man from Atlantis. Sorry.
People can look it up. The man from Atlantis. You won't believe what you'll find.
Bobby. No, what was his name? Bobby. Patrick Duffy.
Patrick Duffy.
That's it. Yeah, I'm thinking of Dallas, because obviously he was in that as well. Bobby Ewing.
Any grandmothers tuning in will know exactly what I'm talking about. Yeah. It's an Adonis.
80s reference.
yellow trunks.
Well, yeah, I mean, I know a similar study was done with my parents used to run a pub many years ago, back in the 80s, funny enough, and on a Sunday that my mother used to prepare roasted potatoes for the customers, and eventually someone had done a study elsewhere that they had measured the urine content of these little finger snacks that you have in bars and stuff during the afternoons or whatever. And it turned out that basically, yeah, they were covered in urine because people were going to the loo, not washing their hands, coming back and helping themselves. So, yeah, kind of puts you off. Snacks in a pub, really. But there you go.
Yeah, it does.
So did you catch up with any of the Trump who exploits? Donald Trump.
Oh, Trump. Who,
yeah.
People haven't been listening. We've been using the Chinese pronunciation now. I've been informed that we don't really say it very well, but it's all right for us to say Trump.
Trump. Right, okay.
Trump.
Yeah, so
I never wash my hair. Anything else? I did watch his, tried to watch his speech to Congress. It wasn't easy to watch.
No.
Because people were literally getting up and applauding. Seemingly every minute, and sometimes more than every minute. It was astonishing. And I didn't think they could really keep it up. In England, if it was a speech at a Tory party conference or the Labour Party conference, you know, it tapers off. But this is America. No, we never run out of energy. We never run out of vitality. So all of them on the GOP side, and Mike Pence and Paul Ryan sat behind Donald Trump. Sometimes Mike Pence was leaping to his feet and Paul Ryan was kind of like, oh, are you really sure about? And then they're kind of, and then Paul Ryan, like, you know, slowly elevating himself to his full height once again, because Donald Trump had just made some other bombshell announcement, like, America will be really sunny and warm, and then they will just jump up again.
Considering
how old some of those people are, they're probably feeling a little sore in the hamstrings and the buttocks this morning. I don't know if they rub DP on themselves before Donald Trump comes out. Maybe the auditorium just stinks like Sunday League football changing room. I don't know the ins and outs of it.
It
was kind of stressing
DP
to watch.
What I thought was funny about it was, and it was difficult to watch, I will say that, was the, one half of the room, the Republicans were basically on their feet cheering and shouting, and then the other half was like they were watching a really unfunny comedy act. They were just sitting there stony-faced, and in fact, at one point, some of them got up and decided to walk out. And even when Trump decided to mention about the widow from the soldier that was killed in Afghanistan in January...
It wasn't Afghanistan, it was Yemen.
Was it Yemen? Oh, right, yeah. So it was basically, she's there kind of mouthing up to the heavens, you know, I love you, to her deceased husband. And the Democrats were just sitting there, stony-faced. You know, it was an interesting kind of shift between the two parties. Did you see the clip with...
I was going to ask you, though, Dave, what do you feel about... Well, you know, the use of the of that woman. Do you think that's fair for her to be there, or do you think that's...
Well, it ties into a number of different levels, I think. Obviously, with what Trump's been saying about the VA and trying to sort out the veterans, because they've been generally neglected. And obviously, when you look at some of the stats to do with that, it comes up that there's quite a high percentage of these people that are committing suicide. And that's never generally mentioned in the mainstream. So he's actually seemingly making a run for trying to get this side of society sorted out, looking after their kind of servicemen and women. But so it ties in with that. So I can kind of see why he used it. But that whole scenario with her standing up, mouthing "I love you" to the heavens, that it's a bit over dramatized for me. You know, it's a sad situation when you lose someone. We've all dealt with grief at one point or another, but that's kind of parading it. And I personally wouldn't be able to do that.
There's been a split, I believe, because if you go on there, I think the family of the guy that died, like his his parents, they're not happy about the operation.
Yeah.
And they've basically been on the side of the idea that it was a senseless operation and a needless death. Not the needless death of all the children that died, but their individual that died. And one of the stories that came out was that supposedly the operation didn't turn up anything particularly of use. And so while the wife may have gone down one track in terms of joining in or agreeing to participate with at the president's request,
There
also seems to be... the other side of this, which is not being happy necessarily with the military carrying out this operation. Glenn Greenwald's got an article up on the Intercept, just come out about this. And he's basically saying his basic take, as usual, is always imagine this from the other side and just think about how we don't permit, you know, the other side's kind of suffering to show its face. He said, you know, they wouldn't show the one of the women that was widowed in that Yemen attack, or the mother of one of the children that was killed. They wouldn't show them and have them, you know, recognized publicly and have their suffering acknowledged. It's always only just our side suffering. His argument is that because of that, effectively, even if it's genuine suffering, it still has a propaganda value because it's always representing our pain, while the pain that we cause others is never represented and never recognised. That's his point.
Yeah. Yeah, and it is... And well, obviously, with when he's suggesting that he's going to be cutting foreign aid and spending more money on the military, so there's only more of this kind of thing to come, I would imagine.
The only thing I did think, actually, just wondering about this now, is a little like suicide bombers before they do a mission. I don't know why American servicemen don't record these kinds of messages to be played back publicly as a kind of response. So when she looked up to the heavens and kind of said, "I love you," his disembodied voice could have filled the auditorium and like delivered a patriotic message about how, you know, wipe away your tears, my love, you know, all the people there, I died for your freedom. That would have got them all. There would have been a 10-minute standing ovation if they pulled that kind of trick.
Didn't she actually get that? Well, she got a 10-minute standing ovation. It was, from all accounts, it broke all records in Congress for the longest.
Oh, did it? I didn't start my stopwatch, but you can see that this would take it up to the next level. If we had, maybe a hologram could appear.
Well,
and
yeah,
they've done it with Michael Jackson, so.
Yeah, they'll be doing it with Prince next, probably.
They did the Peter Cushing one in Star Wars, and it inspired a Guardian article saying, "This isn't fair on Peter Cushing." And that's strange because Peter Cushing's dead. I don't know if the person writing the article noted that fact, but apparently you can do an injustice. You can place yourself in the mind of a dead person and say, "Well, I'm dead and it's not on," if you're a Guardian writer. I didn't think it really mattered that much to Peter Cushing, and he hasn't raised his voice about it. But there we are. Maybe we'll come back to some of these Guardian opinion columnists later when we move on to our other issues.
Yeah. Well, I mean, before we move on, it's now I know you sent me a clip. I've had it sent to me a few times actually from a few other people, and the clip about Mika Brzezinski. So, would you like to explain who Mika Brzezinski is and who, more importantly, her father is?
Well, I actually didn't know who she was until this video appeared.
Ah, right.
But once I heard the name, I did do a quick check, and yeah, indeed. Well, I'm not sure if we're developing a theme for difficult to say names, because we had the Milo Yiannopoulos This time we've got, I really don't know how to start. I think it's like a Polish name with a Z at the beginning followed by a B. I really don't know. But Brzezinski is the surname. Now, her father is incredibly influential figure. He's one of these grand strategists on the US side. And basically, he's one of these wise men who determines kind of geopolitical strategy for the US and its military. And he's had a very, very long career and always been at the center. People listening, if they are into this, they might have heard of his book called The Grand Chessboard, which is all his thoughts on geostrategy and what constitutes a great power and what doesn't, and basically how America can ensure its domination of the world. So this is his daughter, and she works at one of the news networks, and it is. You can tell me, because I've got to put the clip here.
Yeah, well, I believe it's I think it's CNN she works for, and we'll play you the clip in a second, but just to build up the clip so you understand what's being said here. Mika and her co-host, along with several guests.
It's actually MSNBC.
Oh, is it MSNBC? Right.
Yeah, okay. She's talking to Joe Scarborough on the clip.
Joe Scarborough. Right, yeah. So she's complaining about how Trump has taken his messaging. Instead of what would normally happen is that the president would run their messaging through the filter that is mainstream media, and then the mainstream media would frame it in their particular way. Well, what he's kind of doing, he's taking it directly to the people via social media and his Twitter account and so forth. So Mika, bless her, she has a problem with this because it means that Trump can basically dictate his own messaging. So we'll just have a quick play of this and see what you think.
Exactly. Right. That's exactly what I hear. What Yamiche just said is what I hear from all the Trump supporters that I talk to who were Trump voters and are still Trump supporters. They go, "Yeah, you guys are going crazy. He's doing, what are you so surprised about? He's doing exactly what he said he's going to do."
Well, and I think that the dangerous, you know, edges here are that he's trying to undermine the media, trying to make up his own facts. And it could be that while unemployment and the economy worsens, he could have undermined the messaging so much that he can actually control exactly what people think. And that is our job.
Yeah.
I love that. That is our job.
Yeah. That was poetry, really.
And it's getting more blatant, I think, nowadays as well, which is... You never used to hear people on mainstream media talking like this. Now it seems that it's all falling apart.
Yeah, definitely. The tension used to be between the administration's line and those who were perceived as the enemies of the administration. And the media would basically help to frame and present those enemies to the American people. But of course, the media can't sit there in their studios framing themselves as the enemy. So Trump's put them in a real bind. So actually, who have they now framed as the enemy? Well, the only person left are Trump and the Russians. And they're just alternating between these two.
Well, it's interesting.
Today we've got another. Well, today we've got this other one with Jeff Sessions, who they're insisting lied under oath. But if you actually read through the quotes and the lines of questioning, it's debatable if he really did lie. He was being asked as part if the Trump campaign had had contact with the Russians. He wasn't necessarily being asked if in his own role as a senator he had had meetings with the Russians. And what they're basically trying to assert is he was an indispensable part of the Trump campaign. Therefore, when the question was asked, you know, he misled or he lied. The way people tend to compartmentalize their roles in U.S. politics generally, it's kind of debatable, really. It's quite possible that he was answering, you know, truthfully, that as a member of the campaign or in his campaign activities, he hadn't met the Russians. As part of his job, he was meeting lots of foreign ambassadors. Also, it's not as if these meetings are themselves secret. They're ambassador level meetings, so it's not like sneaking off to the underground car park, like meeting Deep Throat in the Nixon era. There's nothing to it. So Nancy Pelosi and these guys sitting on their hands last night while Donald Trump was speaking. Maybe one of the things they were consoling themselves with was that they knew that they were launching this hand grenade at the Trump administration the next morning, and the media's gone after it full tilt. And it's a chance for all these Russian ties things to be kind of laundered again. And just, you know, it's just a redo of the whole Russian thing. It appears that this will just never end. We have talked about it each show. It's just going to keep coming up again and again. Today is another one.
I mean, just before we move on, and there is one thing I'd say, but in the sense that, you had, obviously, Trump came out the other week saying that fake news was the enemy of the people. And then, obviously, all the perpetrators of fake news have come out and said, it's like he said that the media is the enemy of all the people, missing out the fact that he said fake news. So now, according to, you know, the mainstream CNNs and so forth, they're sitting there saying, he wants to close down media. He says the media is the weapon of choice against the people. And that's not what he said, but it's the way it's been framed. And it's like we're in the throes of the final death rattle of these mainstream media, because they just seem to be doubling down on everything, not realising that they're just making themselves look more ridiculous as time goes on.
Well, we never saw this for 8 years of the Obama administration. We never saw this day in, day out. Except maybe over on Fox News, but not this kind of assault.
Yeah, but
endlessly.
Yeah, but
no matter how tenuous. Sorry, Dave, but the thing that really brings it home is just how long they spend on these stories. It's like there's no other news anymore apart from getting the Trump administration. There's just simply no other news.
Yeah, and it's, well, when like you mentioned, Fox News with Obama, and there's quite a few clips on YouTube of Obama running down, you know, in fact, one point he turns around and says, you know, if I listened to Fox News, I wouldn't believe me either. You know, so he was running down Fox News on a regular basis when he was in power. And now it's been reversed, but it just shows you that there's more stations that are in with the Democrats and that side of it than Trump's side. It's becoming more blatantly obvious. Anyway.
Well, one thing that the Bush White House did, Bush 43, was if Cheney or Bush were doing some kind of engagement, they had a rule that all the TV channels had to be turned to Fox News. So, you know, there is a bit of this, but like you said, it's usually been selective. Trump has kind of chosen to take it on kind of wholesale. Of course, there's the huge irony, which we have mentioned previously, is that the US government and its various intelligence agencies and its military basically control what is on these news networks. So actually, it's not usually a problem. But the problem has arisen is because the people inside the apparatus who carry out this task of advancing the US government and its various agencies' lines on particular policies are in open, more or less open revolt against Trump. That is the issue. It's like the piano playing the pianist rather than the pianist playing the piano, if you can use that kind of metaphor.
Well, the other one would be, there was a great film actually called Wag the Dog. Very similar scenario. Okay.
Yes, indeed. The other movie that Trump does remind me of a little is Network, which focuses on the relationship between popular politics and TV ratings. I don't know if anyone's... again, it's kind of an old movie from the 70s, but it has a brilliant script. And this guy becomes super famous, this TV host called Howard... It's called Howard Beale.
Yeah, Howard
and
Beale.
It's it's the famous opening the window and I'm mad as hell when he's opening
and
the
I'm
window
not going to take it anymore.
Indeed. And it has an amazing speech at the end where the guy from the network is kind of instructing his dupe, who I guess here would be Donald Trump, although Donald Trump would be a very wealthy dupe. But it ends with this. It's this huge involved speech that maybe I'll post it on the bookarmor.com website. But it ends with this. The world is a business, Mr. Beale.
Yes.
The world is a business. And Mr. Beale says, but why have you chosen me to carry your message? Oh, Mr. Beale, because you're on television. You know, this is it. So Donald Trump is he's not the Facebook president as much as the kind of the TV, the reality TV president. And unfortunately, it seems that his delusions of grandeur extend beyond his actual role. His actual role was to carry on being the TV guy, more or less. And the puppet masters will take care of the rest. But it does seem like, it's not working out so far.
Okay. Yeah. That's one of the best monologues in that film, actually, with that Howard Beale, when he's basically telling everyone, you know, wake up. This is all made up. What are you doing? Kind of thing. So
that's right, of course. He's the in... He's destroying his own medium with his words because he's having a kind of breakdown. He's a man with nothing left to lose. So he begins to tear down the walls and show people that they've been misled. And he actually does have a kind of anti-foreigner rant in there about how the Saudis with their petrodollars have kind of taken over America and the Chinese and the Russians. So there's kind of xenophobia at work in there. But it also reminds me a little bit of the Eisenhower speech when he was leaving office and he had nothing left to lose. And he tried to tear down the walls and warn the people of the dangers of this famous phrase now, the military-industrial complex, as he made his exit. And he was a true insider. He knew what was coming. It does tie in rather, as we move forwards, that Trump this week announced a 10% increase in the massive military budget. I'm sure Eisenhower, he has even more reason to spin in his tomb tonight than Peter Cushing. Can't be happy.
Yeah, more nukes, I think, is what we need.
Yeah, well, Obama signed up to a new generation of nuclear weapons too. The world has almost ended numerous times, not because of nuclear war, but just because of accidents moving around nuclear materials. There's an American journalist written a very detailed account of all kinds of near misses involving the transportation of nuclear materials around the US. And as he points out, none of these nuclear warheads getting any younger, and all the infrastructure and the computer systems are like they're reminiscent or synonymous with the kinds of computer systems that NASA used to put men on the moon, which, as most people know, had less computing power than a Casio calculator. So he says that, again, the great risk is not from a conflict, but just from simply from an accident, from an accident. Yeah.
Well, I remember doing the alerts in the 80s at school, you know, watching the films about nuclear war and what you would do if there was an explosion. You died under a desk because that would really sort you out.
Well, I lived in the Midlands. Things couldn't get any worse. They didn't bother doing any nuclear drills.
Yeah, you just torch yourself where
they
you are.
They just told us that you don't have to come to school the next day. We're all kind of happy about it.
Okay, so moving on. UKIP.
Okay.
With losing the Stoke by-election. Bit of a shocker, would some would suggest. Not really, though. We've been following this, obviously, for the last several weeks with the adventures of Paul Nuttall.
I don't know what Paul Nuttall's going to do, because there's another 9 months before pantomime season kicks off.
Yes, he's be twiddling his thumbs. He'll be doing some performance art on some street corner, surely.
He's got to walk around with people shouting, "Oi, you're Paul Nuttall," like this. It can't be easy. It really can't, because, you know, he's not really made too many friends he can't show himself around Liverpool football ground anytime soon.
Ah, yes.
But they did this Stoke by-election, but now they've kind of gone into a new fight, which seems to revolve around Nigel Farage not receiving an honour. I can't really work out why Nigel Farage deserves any kind of recognition.
Yeah.
Twisted though the honour system is. Is he a paedophile?
Yeah. I don't know. Has he paid an awful lot of money to the government?
Has he drawn lots of cartoon pictures and asked people, do they know what it is yet? Well, he couldn't fix it for Paul Nuttall. But there is a story coming out that he did fix it during one of the election, during the Brexit campaign. Now, this is a very interesting story today. You might not know this one. Stephen Kinnock, a man who you can confirm with a minute's research has never worked in his life, but he is an extremely wealthy individual. He's joined the family business, which is milking the EU for money.
Yeah, EU,
I also have to say, I don't mean to be personal, but he does have very objectionable face.
In what sense?
Did you ever? Well, I've already made a lot of cultural references tonight. I'm not being sponsored for every TV show that I mention. And the older they are, the more money I get. It's just perhaps the way I feel tonight.
Yeah, it's a generation thing.
Did you ever watch the TV show Minder?
Yes, Minder, of course. It's a classic.
Well, which character from Minder do you think he looks like?
I would say Arthur Daly.
You're terrible on names.
I know, I'm terrible. So who is it then?
I will tell you, he looks like the copper from Minder. And for anyone listening, you're probably already saying, it's not Dave from the Winchester, if that's going to be your first guess.
I don't even remember the copper. I mean, I'm picking some sub-character that's probably made a cameo once.
His name was Chisholm.
Chisholm, right. Okay, that's
but now Chisholm. Now, Stephen Kinnock, he looks like Chisholm. He's got a policeman's face, and he's what's known as a Ramona. And he's fingered Nigel Farage because apparently they receive lots of guidance from a company that uses artificial intelligence to target people on Facebook and feed them the kind of material that may sway their opinions based on what they've liked on Facebook. And supposedly the Brexit campaign received a whole bunch of assistance, which, if its financial value had been assessed properly, would have carried the Brexit campaign over its spending limit. We're back to this spending limit. kind of argument that we've also seen with the general election. But Farage has been kind of dealing with that. Now, I'm not a big I don't really think this story is going to go anywhere. And there's one part of the story which the Canary has got it. I think this is the stretch. It says, if it did, the value of this donation in kind, this is if this assistance took place,
yeah.
The value of this donation in kind would likely have pushed the Brexit campaign over its legal spending limit. And here's the bit I don't agree with. Here's the jump. Raising serious questions about the validity of the EU, the EU referendum result. That's the part that is the stretch.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, if I may just say a couple of things.
It won't go anywhere, but the story is out there. It's interesting that in an era of fake news that Aaron Banks, there was a tweet about it at the time that Aaron Banks made saying, interesting, since we deployed this technology in leave.eu, we got unprecedented levels of engagement. One video, 13 million views. AI won it for Leave, and he's got like a Twitter going off to, he's got a link there going off somewhere else. Aaron Banks in his own words there. So the fake news, the propaganda, the kind of algorithms that are being used to guide you or nudge you, as the nudge unit at Downing Street, this kind of approach to just pushing people in a particular direction. It's all going on all of the time, and it's just a question of how subtle it is or how obvious it is.
Right. But
the one thing that you can be sure of, it's happening all of the time,
right,
everywhere.
But hang on a minute, Jay.
That's the environment, the information environment.
Right, hang on a minute, Jay. Right, so there's a couple of things there, I'd say. First thing would be, is it a shock, really, in the scheme of things, that political parties are, I know it's not AI, let's not over-egg it a little bit, it's algorithms, right? And, I mean, Google uses this all the time. Facebook uses this all the time. You only get certain posts on your newsfeed. This is how data is basically being managed now, being manipulated. It's not managed, it's manipulation. So I would suggest that, actually, that it's a natural progression for politics and political parties.
Well, of course it is.
Yeah, yeah.
Of course it is. So
I wouldn't necessarily say that's out of the norm. That's generally the way, you know, big data is big business now, and that's how it's being moved around.
Well, actually, as you say, nowhere in the story does it really say that it's necessarily morally wrong to manipulate people. What it's saying is it's wrong to not declare the expenses or not declare the value of some assistance you're given. So you can manipulate people as long as you write it down.
Right, but hang on a minute. But didn't the Remain side during the referendum, they spent £3 million pounds on leaflets that they were basically posting through people's doors. This was propaganda being paid for by the taxpayer for the benefit of the taxpayer for voting to stay in the EU. And when the Brexit camp decided to say, well, this is unfair, where's our £3 million? They turned around and said, no, you don't get that, right? So, and also the Conservatives.
Absolutely.
Well, just wasn't it just before the referendum that the Conservatives had got caught in doing some shenanigans with their electoral money that they their election fund that they'd had, that they were only supposed to spend certain monies on certain things, and it turned out that they may have broken the election funding rules or something, and there was a big investigation, and it was going to go to court, but that was just before David Cameron decided to step down.
Yes, and actually, you mentioned that. That wasn't in our plan for tonight's show, but I have a very interesting website. This has been put together by some citizens, and it's isbuc.co.uk. Now, if people go there, what they'll find is it's 2015 UK general election expenses investigation. Now it says 2015 because of the kind of the long campaign and then the short campaign. So it is the last election that took place in 2016. What this person's done, and their confederates, is they've compiled all of the publicly available information on MPs who may have overspent, and also on the progress of any investigations into them. Any media coverage, any social media posts that may be incriminating. Now, what most of it revolved around, for people that maybe didn't follow it, or just a refresher, just to check where we are, was this there are two different kinds of spending that go on. There's one is the national campaign organized by Conservative Central Office. Now, their campaigning is promoting the party and its policies. They have they can spend, I think, pretty much as much as they wish. Individual members of parliament or prospective members of parliament fighting their own constituency battles, they have a limit. And the limit is something like 37,000 that they can spend. Now, the problem emerged because the Tories were using this thing called a battle bus. Mm. Now, the battle bus money came from the national money. Do you follow me so far?
Yeah.
Yeah. But the point was, as it visited each particular constituency, sometimes the lines were blurred between promoting the Tory party as a whole and its policies, its manifesto, and promoting individual candidates. The moment you're promoting an individual candidate, that should be written down on the expenses as local campaigning. So this is where the line was blurred. So of course we're in an age of social media. We've got Instagram and Twitter and Facebook. All the evidence is out there, apart from some of it is being deleted with great to try and clear it away. But what this guy's done is he's found all kinds of photos of local campaigns basically interacting with this battle bus and promoting individual campaigns rather than the Tories message, and then sort of cross-referencing it with all their expense claims and seeing if it shows up. For example, it's got one. Should we take one at random?
Go on in.
Amber Rudd. I think she's what's her job now? She's Home Secretary.
Yeah.
And on hers, for example, on her short campaign, she had a spending limit of £15,458. And she said that she spent £14,688 was her total. Now, under transport, she put zero. But if you go into the local paper for Amber Rudd, and a lot of this information has come from the coverage in of the campaigns in local newspapers. So it's not the national level. They've gone in and there's an article on Hastings Independent News. And it's all about an event that she did where that involved having lots of leaflets on a train. And it was to promote some kind of rail link between her constituency, which is in Hastings and London, some kind of faster link. And it points out that she did all kinds of stuff surrounding this train journey. And yet there we have it in her transport section of her expenses that she said that she'd had transport zero. So there you go. So basically, complaints have been made to the police by members of the public or members of rival parties to try and go somewhere with this. Now, the other thing before we move on this website that I really do recommend people check out is it's got a thing on here, the time that's left, because there's a kind of statute of limitations for making these, for bringing them to book. And it's only 66 days left. And as it says, for some inexplicable reason, if you cheat at politics and no one notices for a whole year, then you get away with it. Luckily, someone noticed. The CPS started an investigation. Several police authorities applied for an extension to the time limit available to pursue criminal prosecutions. Time's up on 7th of May 2017. Hopefully, the reason it's all gone quiet is the various police authorities are busily preparing ironclad cases. However, one already dropped case doesn't give much cause for hope. And as you said, I think a little like the expenses scandal that we've talked about before, this is just going to simply disappear. Now, these breaches of campaign spending, these really do affect the validity of the result at the last election, because of course the illegal spending was all targeted in all the marginal seats. And so there's actually a list. It's 52 Tory MPs. If you go and check the majority that the Tories have got in the House of Commons, what do you think it is off the top of your head?
Not much more than 52, I would probably assume.
It's a lot less. It's something like 15, like this.
Yeah, right.
So if these 52 by-elections had to be rerun, you know, potentially you'd have a change of government. Yeah. Fortunately, with Jeremy Corbyn, you wouldn't have a change of government, and these 52 would all probably win again. Unfortunately, that might even be one of the reasons that's kind of advanced to not bother taking this any further. One thing for people that do wonder about how adversarial the political system is in the UK, one thing that does come to mind is, why does Jeremy Corbyn or the Labour leadership not bring this up every single time a Prime Minister's questions?
We've said the same thing. There's a few of the guys here that I've been speaking to. We all say the same thing, that, you know, he's given the opportunity to stand at the dispatch box and he could bring up a whole host of stuff, fractional reserve banking, the corruption, blah, blah, blah. But seemingly, he doesn't say any of it. And it's very disheartening to realise that he's not going to do anything like that. You know, even when you look at his 32 or 33 years in Parliament, where he's been a backbencher for most of it, and you think about how he's been on the EU, and he was against it generally for the whole way through, right up until he became leader of the Labour Party, and then suddenly he was all in for it. It's disappointing all round, generally.
Well, I think the thing we can say about Jeremy Corbyn is, I am a fan in a way, because he is a man of principle.
Yeah.
But I also do, when you look at it in a cold light of day, all you can say about Jeremy Corbyn is he's had the same principles for a long time and has consistently lived up to them. But you can't really write down on a piece of paper and get very far writing down what he's necessarily achieved. I can't see what kinds of changes he's made. And now he's become leader of the Labour Party. He doesn't really seem to have been able to affect any kind of change whatsoever. It's really going nowhere. I'm torn because, of course, Tony Blair is public enemy number one to me. And the direction that he led the Labour Party in, I don't really want it to go any further. As you've pointed out in the past, every reaction or every action provokes its reaction. And having gone so far to the right since 1997, it was perhaps inevitable that there would be this reaction and you'd have a left, I'm not going to say extreme left, but quite a way to the left, leader of the Labour Party. And it's just not happening. The public, the media campaign definitely doesn't help, because Jeremy Corbyn has been a consistent punching bag for the right-wing media, which is most of the UK media, and the BBC I count as part of this. So he definitely has had a very difficult ride from the media, but I still feel, despite that, he's just not inspiring enough, and he won't do enough to get people that aren't Labour Party members voting for his party anytime soon. So as I say, it's kind of an academic debate, because if you reran these 50 races now, 52 races, I still think the Conservatives would probably win them again and would retain their majority. The only thing that would be satisfying would be if the police could actually peg something on some of these people and just pack a few people off to jail. That would be the only satisfying part, I think. But again, highly unlikely.
Well, at least in the by-election, Labour won that in Stoke. So, but let's be honest, if it weren't for them, it definitely weren't going to be Paul Nuttall, was it? So,
well, also, it was incredibly low turnout. It appears people in Stoke appeared to be terminally depressed and disaffected. They were the lowest. They had the lowest turnout for the general election, and they managed to beat, you know, the apathy level for this by-election. It was, for Paul Nuttall, it was a meltdown. Farage's dispute with Carswell is partly to do with the shift that UKIP need to undergo.
Well, let's hang on.
UKIP kind of lost their reason to live after they won the Brexit vote, or played a major part in the Brexit vote. But Farage's next move is for UKIP to become a radical anti-immigration party. And he said Carswell's getting in the way of this. So that's why Carswell has to go.
Right, well, let's just, so people are informed, so they know, we don't assume, hopefully, too much, that Douglas Carswell is indeed UKIP's only member of, you know, the House of Commons. He's on his own when he sits in there. So when Jay mentions about him being thrown out, they're looking at throwing out their only MP.
And you have to also mention that he came to UKIP from the Tories. He defected, so he didn't actually win a by-election. UKIP have yet to win a by-election. They do retain their deposits these days, so they're doing better than the monster raving loony party. But Carswell was their only MP because he defected from the Tories. Now the talk is that, although the Tories aren't very happy, that he's going to go back to them. And it's become increasingly bitter and personal. And Farage referred to Carswell this week as a posh party boy Tory. So if Farage calls you posh, then you must be very posh.
But was it Farage that started this quarrel, or was it Carswell? Because obviously Carswell had mocked Farage for not getting one of these empire honours that the Queen was handing out.
It's not just mocking him for not getting it. It's supposedly that Carswell might have been a bit active in sabotaging Farage's chance. So that is the undertow to this. But he did make a thing. He said maybe you'll get an MBE. He said maybe even an OBE, which I think is the lowest one. And he said you'll get an award for services to headline writers. To take it right back to the top, while we've been talking about this, I've had another part of my brain, again, trying to come up with reasons to honour Nigel Farage. I still can't think of anything. Has he played football for England? I'm not sure. Has he won an Olympic gold medal?
No.
I don't know which event it would be. It would be the Monty Python's Upper Class Twit of the Year.
A banker.
They have to shoot a dead rabbit pegged out on the ground.
It was a banker.
He was. So I really still can't work it out. But there we go. But he's not happy with Carswell. Now, Aaron Banks, who we also mentioned, has been getting involved. He's the money man for UKIP. And what he said is he might stand against Carswell in Essex. So you'd have the spectre of an expelled UKIP MP fighting in a race against the chairman of UKIP, or the main donor of UKIP. But actually, I jump ahead of myself there, because Aaron Banks is stamping his foot now and saying, make me chairman of UKIP. And as he writes the checks, I think they'll have to accede to that request. But that would be an amazing spectacle. It would be like Kramer versus Kramer. We'd have UKIP versus UKIP.
Well, I mean, according to the Telegraph, his office has confirmed that he is... he intends to stand in Essex. So what's unsure is whether he'll stand as the UKIP nominee or indeed an independent. But, yeah, he's definitely standing.
So you could have an independent candidate who actually
pays for UKIP.
You could have an expelled UKIP incumbent who may by then be a Tory again. I don't know what they're going to do. It's going to be they're going to need to have the local people go on 6-week training courses to get up to speed with the internal politics at work. I don't know. Or they may have to tweak their algorithms quite a bit to push things in the right direction. You can see people's brains just exploding. I don't really know what the people of Thanet have done to deserve this kind of madness. I've never having visited there.
No, I've never been to Thanet, actually. Or Thanet, however it's pronounced. Right.
Sure.
Is there anything else we need to cover on the UKIP front that we've missed?
The only thing we can say is, well, we'll pick up on the latest UKIP madness as we go, but it is one of those things that it's a bit like going back to my diseases at the hospital. If you can just ignore them and forget about them and just hope they go away, it's that kind of thing. I don't think we should keep, if you've got a, you know, it's one of those things we shouldn't keep scratching at. No, your mum might say, leave it.
Right. Was it the, I did hear, just as a little caveat, that talking of someone, there were some psychologists that were analysing the way, like, Trump speaks, for instance, and they have come up with the idea that he may have syphilis or something, because it's like the speech pattern that he has is kind of reminiscent of some early onsets of various mental health stuff or illnesses, terminal illnesses where your brain goes first and then the rest of you follow shortly afterwards.
I'm not a psychiatrist, but I have my own clinical diagnosis, having analysed Trump and his body language and his speech patterns, and that would be that he's American. In my own diagnosis.
That's a fairly accurate.
One thing I wanted to say about one last thing about UKIP, which is I think we should wear those things, like, you know, the dogs wear the lampshade, the upside down lampshade on head. To stop them scratching themselves. That's how I feel about UKIP. I should go around wearing one of those, so I can't really read the stories on my smartphone or see the face of Paul Nuttall on my TV screen.
That would be, if you do that, please send a picture in.
Send us an Instagram. Yeah. I was just trying to get away there because I don't really want to talk about syphilis for too long, but you're the one that brought it up.
I know, I apologise. And anyway, he's out there now. Too late. So now the biggie. So the transgendered agenda.
I don't know if we can call it the trans agenda.
Trans agenda. Yeah, maybe. It's definitely been kicking up a gear over the last couple of years, but there's been obviously a lot of developments in recent weeks. Where do you want to start with it?
Well, I did come up with one thought today while I was reviewing the material on the trans agenda. Now, this was firstly in the civil rights movement when they had segregation in America, that racial segregation. Of course, at that time they had gender segregation too, but it was they also had racial segregation. So you had whites only bathrooms, you had kind of whites only eating areas. There was the famous Rosa Parks the black people having to sit at the back of the bus. Actually, at that time, white people traveled on the bus. But if anyone's lived in the US in the last 20 or 30 years, you'll realize that by now there's no problem with where black people sit on the bus because there's only black people on the bus. Only poor people, usually black, are traveling on the buses there. Now, it's now moved on that the fight is still about bathrooms, but it's no longer the racial segregation. It's this gender segregation and about is a male and female bathroom sufficient or not, or should people be able to use the bathroom that corresponds to the gender that they've selected for themselves rather than the their biological their sex, you know, that they were born with. So that's where the debate is going. Now, I found this and to sort of show the transition, it's gone from which bathroom to use to basically in this NBC news story, we're actually going inside trans students and we're entering their bowels. Did you see this story?
I came across something similar, but that was to do with a member of the forces. But anyway, carry on. In fact, I came across some horrific stuff last night looking at this, but anyway.
If trans students are not able to go and use the bathroom of their choice, and this may now happen on an increasing basis because Donald Trump has reversed the federal guidance on bathroom use. Mm. This is major stuff for certain people in the US. Doctors have come out and said that transgender and gender non-conforming children, apparently that's two different groups, if they refrain from going to the bathroom, it puts them at an increased risk for urinary tract infections and constipation, according to Dr. Robert Garofalo, division head of adolescent medicine at Lurie Children's Hospital in Chicago. In extreme cases, it can lead to encopresis, or uncontrollable soiling, which Garofalo has seen in a few of his younger gender non-conforming patients. So we've moved from syphilis to uncontrollable soiling within the space of minutes. I do apologize. We should have had trigger warnings on this segment of the show. But it's just to show that we've gone from the kind of the which bathroom to use to actually sort of going inside the human body now, and the battleground now are the bowels of gender non-conforming children. My big solution to this today was that maybe all students could wear diapers until they graduate. That was my new big idea, and just do away with bathrooms full stop.
See, there was a great clip that I should have...
What do you think about this idea?
Well, wasn't there Billy Connolly had a great clip where he had incontinent trousers that you would tie up at the legs. Right? And so you'd go around doing your day's work or whatever, and you'd just be going in your leisure. No one would know. You know, but by the time you get home, you'd have to empty the things out. But you'd be walking around like the Michelin man.
Well, actually, these days, as you know, we've talked about some of these I think the kind of algorithms or computer software that's being used in certain workplaces, particularly call centers and warehouses. And in the global south, and it is becoming a thing in the US and even maybe the UK now, it might be apocryphal, but there are definitely documented examples. And that is of the call center workers basically sitting in their cubicles wearing diapers because the targets no longer permit them the time necessary for these bathroom breaks. So you've heard about that, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, just before Christmas.
Well, having students wear diapers throughout elementary, middle and senior high school would be ideal preparation for when they go and work in a call center or warehouse afterwards.
Yeah. Well,
I'm thinking of the future.
Well, I know with companies like JD Sport, they have a three-strike system. So if you – one of the strikes could be that you spent several minutes in the bathroom. And you'll get a strike for that. So this is what puts the pressure on people wearing diapers already. I mean, it's crazy. This is just, you know, beyond what you'd expect.
There's an account of... Well, this goes into another interesting thing if I bring up Amazon. Now, Amazon's got this guy in charge, Jeff Bezos. Now, one thing is, it's kind of double-sided. There's a double-sided aspect to this. If you go and search on the internet, there's all kinds of TED Talks and Forbes magazine and these kinds of articles where you'll see Bezos heralded as a genius because of the profitability of the Amazon corporation that he's built. So there's this kind of article. He's genius. But what is the secret of this profitability? There's an investigation that was published and it was written by a journalist that went undercover working in an Amazon warehouse in the US in the run-up to the holiday season. What they found was the warehouse system was ruled, as you said, by these kind of three strikes kind of policy. But it was ruled by a time management kind of software that allocated, you know, everyone's time to do particular things. Now, people working in one part of the warehouse, if you were 10 minutes away from the nearest bathroom, and of course, these facilities are enormous. They're like aircraft hangars. If you were 10 minutes away, you know, your break time did not take into account the amount of time you needed to get to this bathroom. And so basically this workers were literally running to the bathroom to try and do their thing and then come back to work and not miss a target. Everything's being logged. So to the second. And what was happening was, of course, it's having a kind of disastrous impact on people's the quality of their work life, their work existence. Now, another thing that was happening was they didn't really have a proper heating setup. And this warehouse was or cooling setup. This warehouse or aircraft hangar was somewhere like Arizona. So somewhere very hot. Now, workers were just collapsing because of the heat and the conditions and the pressure they were under. Now, the Amazon solution to this was simply to have a medical tent there. You know, not to do anything preventive. It was simply to put the facilities there so that when you did drop, they could take you off to their tent and revive you. You know, what kinds of... This isn't genius. There's no genius there. But if you look on the TED Talks, I mean, I'm a big, you know, some people do like TED Talks and will kind of promote them. I absolutely detest the kind of people that are invited in the main onto the TED thing, because it is just this very one-sided approach, which kind of presents people as these incredibly gifted and wise individuals with some kind of vision thing, which is propelling them to, you know, heights of success. Whereas actually, it's treating workers like garbage and having this kind of setup where you're literally wringing every last ounce of energy out of your workforce. It really is very abusive. So yeah, like I say, perhaps I'm just tongue in cheek, but maybe they could make school more like one of these Amazon warehouses and just start you off right at the beginning. there is a big thing which we could talk about here, is that US schools are actually becoming very much like prisons in some senses, with some schools even having, I think now, jail cells to hold unruly students in. And this is also being seen as kind of preparing them for their life in jail, should they be one of the people that the system selects for the to populate the nation's prisons. And there's all kinds of videos of police officers inside US schools doing all kinds of awful things to the students there.
Yes,
so again, it's this idea is education to promote the individual and to develop their abilities, or is it simply to make them understand this is your place in the system? You get with the system or not, but if you go against it, it comes down on you so incredibly hard, you know, if you're lucky, you'll live to regret it.
Well, you say you're that, you know, you say this about the education. We'll get to the UK with the government stepping in, bringing in sex education in the UK schools, and we'll get to that in a minute. But, you know, there's, well, you've got this kind of thing going on in the schools in America. You've also got these various cases where you've got transgendered children. I mean, you told me several days ago about the transgendered boy who in Texas who ended up winning a girls wrestling championship. Would you like to explain that one?
Let me get it.
Right. I mean, I can play.
Actually, he's not.
I can play a clip.
We'll have to make it clear that he's going from being a girl.
Girl to a boy.
Being a boy.
Yeah.
When you say transgendered boy.
Well, transgendered boy, as in.
What we should say is he's kind of going from being a girl. He was born a girl.
Yeah.
And he's making the trip to being a boy. And as part of that, he's taking testosterone.
Of course.
And as we talked about last week with the athletes, scientists have said basically that although there is a very, very small overlap between the quantities of testosterone in the male population and, you know, the women with the highest levels, there's a very, very small overlap. But scientists said, actually, if you had to say that the presence of a single substance in this quantity, it is the decisive one between men and women, it would be testosterone. Basically, it's basically what determines sex. So he's taking testosterone. So, of course, he's becoming more male-like. And he's testosterone is really responsible for the quantity of physical strength. As has been pointed out, and any parent can back this up, is until puberty, boys and girls can play together and they can play their team sports together. But once the boys begin to go through puberty, you have to separate them because the boys just have just a physical advantage. They just have more power and strength, and it becomes a matter of protecting the girls from these boys.
Well, right.
So 17 years old, 17. And basically he's been told that in the state of Texas, you can only wrestle based in the category of the sex you were born in. So he must wrestle as a girl in the girls' competition. So basically, he wants to wrestle, but he would rather wrestle boys, but he didn't. He went into the girls' competition, threw a bunch of girls around, and won. And the girls' parents are furious about this because they said, and I think this is a fair point,
yeah,
they said if their daughters were taking testosterone, that would be seen as a performance-enhancing drug. They'd be banned from competition, but a person taking it for a different reason still benefits in the same way and can then walk away with this title.
Right.
But not only that, also puts their daughters at risk of injury due to this physical advantage he's got. So it's this nonsensical story going on. The parents of the boy are saying that the people that complain are demonstrating their ignorance, whereas my take on it would be, if he really wants to wrestle and only wrestle boys, as he says, he should have declined to take part in the female competition. To me, that would be the noble course. He could have made his case in that way and said, look, I'm being deprived of what I want. To actually go into the girls' competition and throw them all around seems rather unfair. And in another competition that he entered, he won by default because the girl in the final forfeited. So again, it doesn't really seem like they're up there on the moral high ground, no matter how much you might sympathise or not with his circumstances.
Right. I'll play. We've got a clip. It's like an overview of what's going on.
It's the dramatic end to a competitive and controversial weekend for Mac Beggs. The 17-year-old Dallas area high school student won the title of champion in the girls' state wrestling competition Saturday.
Hear the boos.
A mix of cheers and boos directed at the wrestler as he fell to his knees, appearing to soak in the win. Many in the audience feel Beggs has an unfair advantage on the road to victory. Beggs is a transgender athlete, born a girl, transitioning to become a boy. He takes testosterone injections to make that transition happen. Many believe that provides the young wrestler with an added competitive edge. His strength and agility are hard to miss on the mat. Then there's the issue of the hormone therapy that would typically be disqualifying. Not in this case, says UIL Deputy Director Dr. Jamie Harrison.
The law is very, very specific that a student who is being administered performance-enhancing drugs by a physician cannot be made ineligible.
So basically, because he's having...
Discrimination, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's why I left that bit in there. It's interesting that you brought it up just before playing.
There's two interesting things there, though. One, it says people who feel he has an advantage, and then it also says people who believe that testosterone gives him an advantage. There's nothing feel about it.
Yeah.
That would be like saying if one person's got a sword and the other one has a machine gun and you feel the person with the machine gun has an advantage. You don't have to feel it. It's there. So again, and then it says they believe. So again, we're kind of back to this thing where either you can assert that anything is true because you feel it, or at the same time, you can assert that whatever someone thinks is wrong because they, you see, it works both ways. Here it's used the other way. Here it's used to deny the evidence in front of your eyes. Other times it's used to say you can't possibly question it. It's what they feel, right? It's like the sometimes you'll notice when the newspapers present the TV presents footage of a police officer basically assaulting someone. And you'll see them with a straight face. They'll show you the clip and they'll say, it appears to show a policeman headbutting someone. Yeah, what do you mean? Appears.
Oh, that's like, you know, that story we said last week, wasn't it? The guy that worked, it was tasered in the face. Unbelievable.
Well, he appeared to be tasered in the face.
Yeah,
Actually, on Taser News, I don't know if you've seen this, but today it's been announced that the police and the Metropolitan Police have been the ones crying the loudest. They want new toys, and they're getting a new double-strength taser that they're going to use on the public.
Well, that cannot be double-strength. It's already 50,000 volts.
Well, this one gives you two instead of one. It's a twofer.
Oh, double hit. Nice.
And they pointed out that although tasers have – people have died after being tasered, they say it's contributory. So it's no good you saying that if you hadn't been tasered, you would probably be alive, because somehow they can decide that an otherwise healthy person who was tasered, you know, it's a bit like the death of Ian Tomlinson. They'll kind of go through your body on the postmortem and comb through your medical records. If you've got an ingrown toenail or asthma, then they'll make a determination that, yeah, while you were tasered, it's quite possible that you might have died from an asthma attack as summer was on its way or pollution levels were high that week. It's just playing with statistics, playing with science. And yes, they're very happy, the police. They're also coming up with this new policy that every time a policeman, an officer, uses his taser to subdue someone, they have to record the circumstances, so where it happened and when. And also they have to record the age and the ethnicity of the person they did it to. So we're going to get a kind of top of the pops of the people getting tasered in a few months. So we'll get our Excel spreadsheet. I'm not a betting man, but if I was, I would be going down to William Hill and having a sneaky fiver on black men being topping the charts.
Overprivileged white people.
The only thing that would change is if, what would it be? Would be like if Boris Johnson got tasered. But didn't Boris Johnson ask to be tasered? I can't remember, because he's one of these buffoons who'd say something like, taser me and show everyone that tasering is nothing to worry
fine.
About.
Yeah.
He's this kind. Like, I think it was Christopher Hitchens who insisted on being waterboarded to show you that waterboarding wasn't torture. Was it Christopher Hitchens?
Yeah, yeah, it was. And then as soon as it started, he's like, stop!
He changed his mind while he was being waterboarded, I think. He changed his mind while it was.
No, no.
But you ever think about that?
It literally just started, and that was it. He put his hand up, and he wanted to get out as soon as it started. He didn't hang about.
You've got to take your medicine, Christopher. The thing is with that, of course, is that you haven't been abducted from the other side of the world and then flown in an aeroplane, shackled inside the body of these cargo planes. You haven't been told that your family are all going to be assassinated, and you're not being looking at indefinite confinement for the rest of your time on Earth. So none of it really provides the context to say that you can reach an opinion on what it is just by having the procedure itself. That would be, I don't know what would be the equivalent. It's like these things where they get the celebrity to live rough for 3 days or something, or 24 hours, and then afterwards they say, "Ooh, it's changed me. It's changed me to be inside the body of a homeless person and to see the way the public ignore you or even abuse you or won't give you any money." You know, it's nonsense, isn't it?
Well, all you'd have to do is ask all the...
Well, you discover what it means to be homeless by sleeping outside for one night in your, you know, specially arranged sleeping bag with a camera crew pointing their cameras at you. No more than you would experience what it means to be black by just doing your hair a different way and tanning yourself and walking around wearing African clothes.
Well, don't we know someone who does that?
I'm thinking of someone. I'll give you a clue. It's not Jimmy Cranky.
No, certainly not. No, we'll get to that in a second. Right, but you say about the 17-year-old wrestler. There's also another 17-year-old who's got a case, interestingly named Gavin Grimm, who's taking. It's going to the the Supreme Court, I believe.
Well, he's going to the Supreme Court with his case, but I'm not sure, you know, that it depends on the bathroom arrangements if he's going to attend in person.
Well, OK, so let's just kind of establish what's going. Well, I've got a clip. Shall I play the clip or shall I explain it? Shall I play the clip?
Well, one thing I will mention is my favourite writer, one of my favourite writers, Will Grigg, has got an amazing blog post that goes into this. It's called Gavin Grimm's Totalitarian Fairy Tale. And he just talks about the way that Gavin Grimm's feelings about who he is, his gender identity, it basically recruits us into what's philosophically known as kind of solipsism. You know, it basically recruits us into his solipsistic perspective. You can ask what solipsism is if you don't know.
Go on in.
Solipsism is a philosophical argument where basically only things that are real to you are real.
Yeah.
That is the kind of argument. And things that feel real to you, other people have to accommodate these things. Usually it's discarded in kind of philosophical debate. It is a position, but it's kind of discarded because, as you might guess, it's kind of hard for solipsists to meet one another or interact with one another.
Right. So I've just...
Really work. But Gavin Grimm, if we listen to him talk, maybe we'll get an insight into his thinking.
For a period of 7 weeks after I came out my sophomore year, I used the men's room with no issue and things were fine. It looked like I was going to have a normal high school experience where I was supported as any other student was. But obviously things didn't continue to go that way and I was barred from the men's restroom, and this is what ended up happening as a result.
Because as I understand it, there was a member of the community who wasn't comfortable with you using the boys' bathroom.
That would be a parent, probably.
Or the men's room. And then what happened? What did you have to do?
So there was a school board meeting and I had to attend, or I chose to attend, and they debated whether or not I was to use the men's room there. And then they ultimately decided I was not able to. And then I got in contact with the ACLU and we put things in motion.
In perspective. He was going to say, then we put things in perspective. Interesting.
Now, as I understand it, what the school...
Sorry?
what I was going to say was also that someone felt uncomfortable. Well, so again, you know, but those feelings can be overridden. It's just special classes, protected classes of people whose feelings will, you know, rearrange the laws or rearrange the regulations, while other people's objections can be kind of waved away. Again, we get this, you know, maybe that was genuinely feeling uncomfortable. If you're a boy and you don't feel comfortable using the boys' bathroom, then where are they meant to go then?
Right. Well, let's continue.
Came up with was a special accommodation for you. They found a unisex bathroom somewhere in the school that you could use. Why wasn't that good enough for you?
Well, an accommodation is an exclusion. I'm a boy like any of my other peers, and I should be able to use the boys' room like any of my other boy peers.
But I mean, if, you know, look, sure, but sometimes we all make special accommodations for our own circumstances, and if there was a unisex bathroom for you, why did that feel bad to you?
Well, again, because it's an exclusion. It's saying that I'm not fit to be in communal spaces with my peers. It's saying I'm different from them. I'm not deserving of the same opportunities that my peers get. And I don't pose a threat or any form of harm to people using the correct bathroom. Civil rights are not state issues. They're everyone issues. And if you leave civil rights up to the states, people will wait very, very extended amounts of time to get their rights.
Where'd you go with that?
I don't know what to say. And if these kinds of maybe a third kind of bathroom just for people that don't feel that they, well, the problem here is that he does feel he fits in. Sometimes we get these kinds of issues where they're trying to argue against what they call these cisgender things. It's what these trans activists of label everyone who basically whose biological their gender at birth matches their kind of their gender identity. This is their basic, depends on if you really believe that there's something detachable, which is your gender identity from your, how you're born. They suggest there is. I don't know.
Right.
We're kind of familiar with the idea that there's differing kind of sexuality. So you can have two people born male, one's attracted to women, one's attracted to men, one's attracted to both. We can kind of understand that sexual identity, but the idea of a gender identity that you're born, you have a particular body and then you reject like your sort of your set of reproductive organs. You just kind of reject them and say, well, no, that's not actually me.
Right.
Not really.
At that point,
you have to decide. People have to decide for themselves if you really want going to entertain that that does take place just because people say they feel it does. And then secondly, is it really something that would happen on the scale that it seems to be happening?
Right.
Or is it becoming more?
Right, but Jay, hang on. There's a couple of things there that I'd like to jump in, right? There's a couple of things. The first thing is, in various surveys that have stated that, you know, that what's the percentage of the population that is actually transgendered, it's remarkably low, right? So they're putting in these laws and changing society for the sake of a very few number of people. Now, there was
one number I saw was 1 in 2,500.
Yeah, it's ridiculously low, right? Now, there's a woman who had a very interesting take on this, Kara Dansky. She proclaims herself as a radical feminist, right? And it seems that she has these radical feminists have teamed up with some evangelists and various other groups that you would not necessarily associate with joining together for a common cause. The common cause would be trying to get some sense of rational kind of argument going on instead of this, I feel like to be this, and so you must now treat me like this. So it's a 2:52 clip. If you want to say something, Jay, shout and I'll stop it. But it's got a few interesting points I'd like to play on it and we'll discuss afterwards.
I'll just let you play it, Dave, instead of...
What's that? Sorry?
Said I'll let you play it
of
keep trying to jump in there.
All right.
Far beyond bathrooms. And so when people talk about this as a bathroom bill or a bathroom controversy, it's really not about that for us. In part, it goes to... within the realm of like the bathrooms, locker rooms, changing rooms, shower rooms, what the interpretation of sex to mean gender identity means is that potentially any male who self-identifies as female can access any women's bathroom, locker room, changing room, et cetera, dormitory, school. Yes. But it goes even far beyond that to redefine women and girls to mean essentially anyone who identifies as a woman or girl for purposes of Title IX, which matters to us because we think that women and girls are a meaningful category worthy of civil rights protection. Well, Title IX was enacted in 1972 specifically to remedy centuries of discrimination against women and girls because women and girls had been discriminated against in and excluded from the educational arena for thousands of years, at least hundreds of years. And Title IX was specifically enacted in order to remedy that. But now, if we define sex under Title IX to mean gender identity, what we're essentially saying is that women and girl can mean anyone who self-identifies as a woman and girl, which renders the category women and girls meaningless as a category. And it goes further than that. We see this in language all throughout society. We see, for example, women are no longer allowed to talk about body parts. We're not allowed to talk about pregnant women. We have to talk about pregnant people. We're not allowed to say that women have certain kinds of body parts. Language is degrading. We're seeing the erasure of women and girls as a meaningful
language
category.
And thought along with it. So acknowledging biological reality is now hate, in other words.
Yes.
Right, I'll stop it there. That's kind of it on the head in the sense that it's not about biological difference. It's about how you want to. It's your decision. The science has got nothing to do with it. It's your decision. You can say what you like.
And if it's backed up by some professionals, then on it goes. And as you say, sort of laws and regulations are being designed to cater to this. One thing that's going ahead is the government. It's a conservative government, but they're implementing some new some changes to the Education Act, and they want to introduce this compulsory sex education in UK schools. Now, Peter Tatchell and Stonewall, these kinds of organizations, they're in favor of this because they want to basically begin the process of normalizing the issues that we're talking about here. So they want children perhaps as young as four to be told that there's all these various kinds of normal and all kinds of different relationships, and the materials, the educational materials, are kind of produced to demonstrate this in the classroom. So to me, I would think it's quite an important issue that people are pushing this kind of agenda to basically greatly diversify on the basis of these this notion of gender identity. It's a coming issue. That's why we kind of keep going back to it. But the woman there made some very good points that fundamentally women and girls get erased if people could just decide. And we did mention it in our segment on this on last week's show that Ian Huntley basically is buying nail polish and wearing makeup and asking prisoners to identify him by the name Leanne instead of Ian as a prelude to making an application to be moved to a woman's prison because he now feels that he identifies as a female rather than a male. Could anyone think of another way, anything quite so preposterous as a prisoner being able to get themselves transferred in this way between prison populations? Prior to this issue coming up onto the radar, there would have been nothing on this earth that would have facilitated such a move. But lately, it seems that the right of the individual to decide where they this gender identity has become paramount in the decision making. And we've had some instances. There was a trans woman, someone who basically lives as a woman, but she is biologically male and she hasn't had any of the kind of transitional surgery, but she went into prison and they put her into a men's prison, and she became in the UK, I don't know if you followed her story, I don't know her name off the top of my head, but she became a kind of cause célèbre for this these trans activists in the UK, saying it was kind of tantamount to torture to place her inside a male prison, saying that she was going to be kind of used for sex because of her gender identity. Did you follow her story?
She had been on what's that favourite BBC programme? Victoria.
Oh.
Yeah, what's her last name?
Not Victoria Derbyshire.
Derbyshire, yes, Victoria Derbyshire. In fact,
absolutely terrible.
Well, hang on a minute. Interesting. Well, Victoria Derbyshire, she used to do Women's Hour, funny enough, on Radio 4. And the woman that's taken over from her, because since then, you know, she's gone on to the TV. But the woman that's Jenny Murray has basically come out and said, well, part of this sex education thing, we know we give the kids Jane Austen and we teach the kids how to analyse Jane Austen. Well, we should do the same thing with porn. We should give kids porn and teach the kids how to analyse it. Oh, yes, the director's got an excellent shot there.
Yeah, it is one of those things, isn't it, where I think actually the kind of the nature of pornography is that it kind of resists, as you're watching it at least, much attempt to analyse it. And that's kind of its purpose, is it's not there to be analysed.
You're not overthinking it so much.
You use pornography and pornography uses you. You did used to get, back in the day, the broadsheets would occasionally run an article on pornography, and it would run along these kind of lines. While I sat down and watched several blue movies with titles like Debbie Does Dallas and Big Jugs, and I must admit, I found them not arousing in the slightest. You always had this kind of article, maybe a British Legion type, but the inference would be that I simply can't see what it's all about. They never said, you know, since I watched these porn movies this weekend, my life has changed completely. I'm now a hopelessly addicted to every form of erotica. Well, now, it was always that you could, it was like trying out a new, I don't know, like a new kind of sports jacket or a new pattern of tie. It was something that maybe not for me. It was this kind of thing.
A bit too racy.
So I'm not really sure how far you'll get with analysing it in the classroom. If you are going to have sex education in schools, I think you should start with the teachers, because there are so many cases these days of teachers having relationships with underage students below the age of consent, that perhaps it's teachers who need to be made aware of what sexual relationships consist of rather than students.
What, just out of interest, Jay, what is the age of consent in Taiwan?
I'm not actually sure.
Because here it's 16.
I'm not actually sure. I'm a middle-aged man, and yeah. I am married to my beautiful wife, so I've never bothered to
it's not something you probably need to know, is it?
Consent. I could find out. I'll sound like one of those stuffy broadsheet people. I will certainly look into the matter, David, and report back.
Oh, thank you very much, sir. Thank you.
They are having a thing here in Taiwan at the moment for the same-sex marriage movement. We basically don't have a kind of activist base that's comparable to people like Laurie Penny or Jack Munro or Owen Jones or some of these kinds of figures, because in Taiwan, unlike the US and the UK, we don't really have the campus university doesn't really work. So you don't have the student population completely cut off from the mainstream of society. So they're unable to turn themselves into these grotesques like Rachel Dolezal, who we may talk about, and the woman at UCL, the minorities officer or diversity officer, who basically wrote all kinds of anti-white tweets on her Twitter feed and then kind of got carpeted and lost her job in the end. People might be familiar with her story. In Taiwan, students aren't able to cut themselves off so much, so they don't tend to be re-educated or turned into these kinds of they're not given that view. But same-sex marriage is certainly an issue here in Taiwan, and that's going ahead. I don't know what your view is, but for myself, I do support same-sex marriage. I don't see really any reason.
No, why, well, you know, if
people can't get married if they want to, if heterosexual people have to have to.
That's it. It'll be your
let everyone else try it too.
Your recent wife will be so pleased to hear that. I have to. No, well, okay. There's a few things I'd like to mention on this. Well, you know, if a classic liberal is this somebody who, you know, go off and do whatever it is you want to do, that's, and I've got no problem with that. So if people would like to get married, end of. People get married, no problem. Whoever it is to, no problem. Got no question in that, right? So, but what, you know, bringing it back to this education thing with the kids in the UK, it's to do with, you sent me an article, yeah, a few days ago that was from The Guardian. So on that, I read that and there was a few memes that I wanted to see if I could hunt down. And I ended up tracing them all over to the paper next door, which was The Independent. And they were given this illusion that they were talking about middle school, comprehensive school. So we're talking about 11 or 12. And in fact, even Sky News recently in the last few days had a woman on there saying the same stuff. We're talking about 11 or 12. Yes, we're going to teach them about the 21st sort of century forms of sex, like sexting. And the fact that they gave out loads of statistics to say that by the time most girls, for instance, leave comprehensive school, which would be up until the age of 16, there is a very high percentage of them that would have taken some naked shots or some topless shots. By the time most juniors leave junior school, go into the middle school, so again, that's around about 11 or 12 that happens, they a high percentage has tried sexting. Right, so they're throwing out all these, you know, this is, you could class this as pseudoscience. This is what we say is happening. This is what we need to do to remedy it. So they're now, you've even got some people turning around saying that to not do this, to introduce 4 and 5 year olds to various forms of sex in the 21st century, is tantamount to child abuse. I would tend to say it's the other way around, you know.
Well, for progressives, there's this idea that knowledge basically trumps ignorance. So if you're on the side of disseminating knowledge, then you win the argument every time, provided the knowledge is has a sound basis. I think the problem here is the mandatory part, the compulsory part, because why should the state and increasingly it's not just the state, is it? It's the people that the state chooses to partner with,
yeah,
to produce the materials, to set the parameters for this curriculum, to decide how to go about it, the approach. Fine, you know, maybe there's a place for it. But to me, the problem is, like you said, the liberal argument is, well, let the state come up with its plan, but it has to be consensual. You have to agree to it. When I questioned Peter Tatchell about this, he said, yeah, but if we do that, lots of parents won't want their children to do it. It won't work unless it's everyone. It's almost like vaccination or immunization kind of argument. Unless we get access to every mind, it just won't take this kind of mind graft. So they basically are going to not be happy until they can approach every child and lead them through this material. The problem I have is that it's just so difficult to say in this sense what is objective information. I can't really see any way to do it that is not always someone's perspective, someone's agenda, basically, just someone's political point. If it was being done and they were talking about modern relationships and they were leaving out same-sex marriages, well, same-sex marriage people wouldn't be happy. Well, they will be included now because society's reached this point. But we've always got other groups or other new identities forming and splintering. They'll be knocking on the door to be represented too. How deep is it supposed to go? Like you said, the trans numbers are only supposedly 1 in 2,500. Yeah. There's intersex people. I don't know quite what intersex is. There's asexual people who don't feel themselves to be sexual beings at all. What's it supposed to be? Are we all supposed to, every child supposed to turn themselves into this is their full-time occupation, becoming expert in this kind of knowledge? I'm not really sure what is in it for the children. I think some people would say that it's just a confusing proposition, especially when it's based on such minority things, to kind of bring it into the classroom. I'm just personally just not convinced on the whole business. When we were at school, sex education amounted to the biological aspects, and you were taught how babies are made and what to do if you don't want to make a baby, what kind of practices you can avoid. But it was done within that framework. It was understood that maybe you find out from your parents what it's about, but you know, it was in the realm of parental responsibility. Parents were being isn't it the Tories that always like to say that they trust the individuals to make their decision? Well, they don't seem to trust them here. And Peter Tatchell likes to talk about freedom, but he doesn't seem to want freedom for a four-year-old to decide they don't want, you know, that they're not going to be exposed to this stuff, or someone in middle school to decide that, well, actually, I object. You know, I don't want this. He doesn't want any parent to intervene. I wonder if we'll see something like the US, where perhaps parents aren't allowed. You know, for example, what if a parent wants to come into the classroom and observe one of these sessions?
You won't be allowed. You won't be allowed to eat. Well, not at all. You see,
yeah. So I noticed. Oh, sorry, Dave. There's one thing I'll mention here. Maybe we'll come back to it next week, because it's the same kind of theme. This kind of social engineering and this belief that you can lead a generation in a different direction if you are able to implant particular ideas in their minds. But Frank Field, the Labour MP, who's also, I think he is a member of the Fabian Society, and they really believe in social engineering. He had a think piece this week, and what he's proposing is that we come up with a new social highway code, which I thought was a very interesting idea.
Wait for it.
You have to check your social rearview mirror before pulling out. So he's written an article all about this, and it's basically – things are terrible. Boys spitting on the floor, girls swearing on the bus, litter on the streets, discarded hypodermic syringes in the playground. It's this kind of approach. And he said, we've got to get the faith groups together. And he said, it won't work if it's only the Christians. We need diverse faiths. So really, it seems like all the way through the article, it's like trying to say, we need Muslims, but he never mentions Muslims. I'm not sure why he's got this kind of code word thing going on. But at the end, he says, last week in Liverpool, I met with some priests and other members of very diverse faiths, and we began talking, and we came up with our first steps, baby steps, towards a social highway code, things that everyone can agree on, and they will lead us into a more civil future. And again, like this sex education, just do wonder if this approach is really going to work. I don't think it would be too hard to write this social highway code. Some people would say it was as simple as the golden rule.
Yeah, mutual respect generally would go down a long way with most people.
But you do have to also take account of the rise of people lacking this respect, perhaps, and it's kind of maybe deeper than something that could be instilled using a social highway code. I think you have these same arguments about poverty, don't you, where people say if people are suffering poverty, then what they need are to come in for adult education classes about how to manage your money. It's this kind of approach where there's some kind of remedy there, which is about, you know, you need to deploy your resources better rather than look at the things that actually do cause people to begin the social fabric to actually break. The social fabric doesn't break just because individuals are kind of at the individual level. You know, it's at a higher level than that. And what you actually find is that people are just kind of victimized, and the system begins to victimize people. You hear the same thing with the kind of Jamie Oliver thing. Well, we need to bring in the working class families and teach them how to cook. Yeah, it's not as simple as basically, it's a bit like the Tony Blair idea that what you have to do is basically, we're the middle class and we need to teach all the other people to be middle class too. And because we know that that is basically everyone's aspiration. You know, it's really not something that is resolved by bringing them there and saying, well, this is how it's done, and sending them away again. You know, it's kind of simplistic way to go about it.
Yeah, it's I just find it quite overwhelmingly. It's quite sinister in certain ways, and just the amount of airtime that these particular kinds of opinions. I mean, we're talking about, you know, if you are in a situation where you can choose your sexual identity by just basically sticking up your hand and saying, I would like to be identified as this, as opposed to anything biological. I mean, the classic example of that, and we mentioned her name earlier on, the Azal.
Well, this is the racial version, not the gender version.
Right, exactly. Well, it's the same thing, though, isn't it? It's all part of the same pie.
It kind of is, because if she believes that she is black, and so to, as far as she's concerned, she is black.
But
one thing that she says is that race is a kind of social construction. So it is possible that someone who isn't, you know, biologically black can come to be embraced or take this social construction as their identity and to merge with it.
Yeah, but they're saying the same thing.
The white caterpillar becomes the black butterfly, is her kind of approach. Now, you know, I do have some sympathy for that argument, because there is a socially constructed part to this. And actually, anthropologists, for example, don't even recognize race as signifying anything kind of meaningful. When we talk about races, what we're really doing is just, it's just, we're grouping things together that, you know, if you began to look at them analytically or objectively, would not be grouped, right? It wouldn't survive, you know, that it's just created in our minds. So that part is fine. But there is this kind of biological component to being black, a bit like you say, the biological component that the woman was talking about. And it's this that kind of gets denied, doesn't it? If you put makeup on to make you look black and then live as a black person for a while, black people basically say that is not really good enough, because black person isn't wearing black makeup that we can take off and be someone else. So this is the kind of pushback against Rachel. But as far as Rachel's concerned, she says, well, I don't feel happy if I have to identify as white, and I never take my makeup off, so it's just like I'm black. That's kind of the argument.
Yeah, and it was a great video of her parents explaining, no, she's white. We don't know. She's ill.
Kind of religious nutcases. They're like Christian nutcases, and they did kind of subject her to a kind of awful upbringing, if we take Rachel at her word. And they did adopt some African-American children that were raised as her siblings. And these, the caring for these children, there's some sympathetic parts to the Guardian interview that they did with her. She began to discover something inside herself, is what she says, from raising these children. And of course, we do talk about it on the show. You can understand why, if you are going to have a conscience and you're a white American and you're interacting with black people, it actually, if you were genuinely going to follow your conscience, you would have to admit that what the white identity has done, or the white so-called white race to African Americans, would make you ashamed of that identity. But, you know, most white people have to kind of, if you do recognize or reach that point, you still have to kind of explain it to yourself by saying, you know, something like, well, I'll be different and I'll do more, and I won't fall prey to this, or I'm not proud of what's gone on, or we need to change this. But for Rachel, her change is the wholesale, you know, conversion of herself to being a black person. That is what she does, because she wants to move over and say, I really do stand, I mean, true solidarity. I thought the interesting thing, I don't know what you think about this, Dave, is if she actually had an operation to kind of permanently blacken her skin so she couldn't take off the makeup, would that make anyone in the black community that have criticized any more sympathetic, or would that just be seen as nutty as Michael Jackson wanting to be white?
Isn't there, there is a condition where, something to do with one of your glands that controls the pigment of your skin, and when that goes slightly AWOL, you can. I mean, there have been cases of black people turning white and vice versa, down to this gland that affects the pigmentation in your skin. So there is possibilities of that. Do it, or having your skin bleached, you know, one of those things. So we have 10 minutes left of the show, Jay. So we're going to go from Jack Monroe, Katie Hopkins and Laura Penny to end up on David Starkey. How would you like to start, wrap all those four together?
Okay, so the connective tissue between Katie Hopkins, Jack Monroe, who is a trans activist, and Laurie Penny, who's a radical, she calls herself a radical, I'm not sure, radical feminist, I think, but she's also kind of maybe a socialist. And Katie Hopkins is the well-known, I think she writes for the Daily Mail, unless she's been fired.
Troll for
but
money.
She's the talking head. She's kind of, she called refugees cockroaches, and she praised the Israeli Defense Forces for shooting dead Palestinian children. She's very unpleasant. She's also had some articles where she went to Cuba expecting to be able to satisfy her cravings for the evils of communism, and she discovered an incredibly cohesive society that she was blown away by. And she did have the bona fides or the honesty or the integrity to recognize that she was 100% wrong. She also did go to the refugee camps in Calais and see it for herself. And it does take a certain amount of physical courage to go to these places, regardless of if you've got a camera crew with you. And actually, a camera crew might invite trouble in these locations. So, you know, I do. She's just as brave as Lily Allen, who I think also went to the camp at Calais. And she did do some kind of sympathetic report on LBC. But she's one of these polarizing figures. But even her own views are not really consistent. So by turns, you'll find these memes on social media saying, you think this about Katie Hopkins, watch this and change your mind. But you watch it and you think, well,
no,
you know, I changed my mind for the duration of the clip, but it changes right back when it finishes. It would be like Jeremy Clarkson having some occasional like day when he goes out and clears up the litter in a park or shovels up dog poo poo. And, you know, it'd be, you know, all right, Jeremy, you know, you can put your spade down. We get it. You're not the worst person in the world. But actually, you know, you're still really, really bad because of all the other stuff you've done. So Katie Hopkins kind of does this. She took issue with Laurie Penny. She took issue with Laurie Penny, who writes at the New Statesman. Now, Laurie Penny is very irritating person. We should say. Yes. She went to an independent school and then she went on to Oxbridge and she kind of became a journalist afterwards. And she's had quite a lot of privilege, but when she writes about her issues, she's always putting a gloss over her own privilege. And basically, even I was reading her latest post about eating sushi with some Brexiteers, and these were three youngish men, like old university pals who were having like a Christmas get together. She kind of continually positioned herself as not quite, you know, as privileged as them, despite the fact that she was kind of passing judgment on their level of education. And she had a very good education. And despite the fact she's published 5 books, and you might fancy that she's got a bit more in the bank than the people that she's sort of placing above herself in this article. But her take is just her supposed brand of radical politics, and people can read it for themselves. But why Katie Hopkins was angry with Laurie Penny was there was some protests in London, I think it was, and a war memorial. Oh, heaven forbid. Some people damaged or sprayed some graffiti on a war memorial. And Katie Hopkins was furious, and she went on there to have it out with Laurie Penny, because Laurie Penny had said, well, there's nothing wrong with it. She said, the bravery of past generations shouldn't cow us in the present. So that was her response. But unfortunately, the wires got crossed, and Jack Monroe, the poverty chef and anti-austerity activist over at The Guardian, who's transitioning to be a man, she got the Katie Hopkins tweet instead, and she was very upset. And she replied saying, "I'm going to sue you. And also, lots of my family are in the armed forces, so I'm mad as hell." And it's finally ended up in the High Court this week. So that is the background to this story. Three of these, actually, they've got far more in common than there's far more that unites them than divides them. But I've kind of enjoyed watching them slug it out. I don't know what your view is on desecrating war memorials.
No, well, just as a caveat on that, Jack Monroe, I think she has actually gone on record saying that she's neither intending to have any surgery or indeed take any reassignment medication. So she is literally just identifying as a man. But while...
She's got very short hair now and she's called Jack.
Yeah, so. And that's the only thing she's done. And that's actually, from all accounts, that's the only thing she's going to do. But yeah, we have to tell her that she's a man. But shall I...
The state of this gender identity stuff is that, although you say that and then we say, okay, and we respect that or we understand, the point that we're trying to get at sort of with this stuff tonight is, the only way it works is because these people are constantly making public, you know, their bodies in this way. So it's like this constant need to expose themselves and tell you all of this. But what seems to have gone missing there is, if we go back to our kind of liberal argument, is and maybe our kind of trigger warning thing, is the notion that the liberal kind of argument was supposed to place those things in the kind of the private sphere. You know, they were supposed to have that part where they could operate. And out there in the public sphere, you know, it wouldn't necessarily have to be all gone through. But the world that they're kind of taking you into seems to be one where, you know, it's like an open biology lesson, or it's like this kind of textbook that you're sort of walk through everyone's history as it happens to them. Social media maybe has intensified this. And it's just if you want to be, you know, free of it, or you don't want to engage with it, well, then it's kind of being turned into this kind of, there's nowhere to turn. Hmm. There's no escape in the US or the UK, at least. As I said, it hasn't reached Taiwan. So I'm safe out here. Maybe we can think about why it's taken hold so much in the UK and US. My own theory, as I've said, is that campus universities and kind of most of the people like Rachel, if we go back to her, you know, she says that the language to describe herself or the way to think about herself didn't arise until she reached college. And then what the professors said there and what she began to be exposed to, it was her way in. And that's why she began to be able to do this. And she used the world of the university as this kind of microcosm to kind of test out this new identity that she wished to take on.
That's understandable. I mean, university.
Well, we all test our identities at university, but it's this idea that afterwards, the whole world, when you leave the university, has to recognize what you've decided while you were there. So campus politics comes to dominate the entire society.
Yeah, and that's not how it's wrong. Right, to
one of these things where you'd start to believe that actually there's only, if you read the media, you'd start to believe that there are only young people, because everything on this kind of trans issues and this kind of journalism, it's all by millennials. You'd begin to think that actually there aren't any people over 40 anymore when you read the newspapers, because it's kind of it is like a student-led kind of cultural movement. So you begin to see one thing they tend to do is that they actually just reject out of hand what anyone older than themselves believes anyway.
Yeah.
As we talked about, all the older activists are all being demonized by these.
Yeah, completely.
This new generation. So like we say, the national media or these kinds of forums, the entire society is turned into this kind of campus. Not really what I had in mind. I enjoyed myself at university, but when I left university, I wanted university to end.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted university to finish. I've always felt a bit sorry for my fellow graduates who kind of, even now, some of them, they still live a bit like they're students. To me, that represented failure. to keep living like you're a student.
Well, yeah, it's the especially some people become too used to it and institutionalized, I think it would be known as.
Well, perhaps with people having to live at home if they can't afford to buy their homes, and people struggling to establish their, their own families or their own kind of meaningful relationships, then maybe for some people it kind of becomes this thing where you don't feel like you've been able to make these transitions. And so it just kind of winds on and on without being a conscious decision. And people just find themselves, just stuck. You just can't emerge from your student cocoon, and it doesn't open, and you don't come out as a butterfly. You're just stuck as a kind of
perpetual student
for the rest of your days. Frustrated caterpillar feels like a perfect place to stop.
Right, well, just so it's a shame because we did have that David Starkey versus Laurie Penny. It's a shame.
That is a wonderful tip, so maybe we can play it next time.
Okay, well, I'll keep that for next time because it's definitely worth
it. It's ongoing, so maybe we just play it as an accompaniment next week.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's only 2 minutes. I could probably cram it in now if you're up for it.
No, save it, I think.
You did that last time with the Israeli clip. Save it.
I want people to return next week and
put
enjoy
it
the
back in the bag. Right, okay then. Well, on that bombshell, we are done for another week. Thank you, Jay, as always.
Thank you, Dave. Been a pleasure.
Right, thank you, everyone, for listening. And hopefully, speak to you next week. All being well. Take care, everybody. Now I've got to play some music. Da, da, da.
Go get the money. 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 This the remix. Sound I'm lit. Hold the line. Cause my hits. Now my plug to White Howard. Cause I'm waiting for the bread.
I'm on the west with OT. I just flew in from the east. On that body smirch. Just caught a body last week. Since they wouldn't let me drink. When I get a post release. I'ma buy so many bottles. They gon' think I'm Big Meech. When I catch that bird, I'ma put it to her beak. No, I'ma put it to her brows. Now they really on fleek. See, I grew up in the jacks. Had to fight for my respect. Elevator wasn't working, so we took the steps. I went years without no sex. So you know that wet. And you ain't a real hustler if you can't bust a check.
Push it, push it, push it, push it, push it, push it. Push it, 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 push it. Go get the money, go get the money. 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 Push it, 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 push it. Go get the money, go get the money.
OT.
Go get the money, go get the money.
Yeah.
Go get the money, go get the money. Go get the money, go get the money.
Gotta push it to the limit.
Push it.
Push it like salt and pepper.
Push it.
Put the on the perky. The cocoa make her feel better.
Cocoa.
She got a groove back, Stella.
Woo.
You ask about her, I'm a seller.
Seller.
I got that wallet vanilla.
White.
Call it Thriller in Manila.
Oh.
Push it, push it, push it. That's it. Bout the bat, we took it. Get it from the rookie. Hand up, seller. Cook it. Got your mate. Cook it, cook it, cook it, cook it. You know, yeah, we sell it. Cook it. And we got hold of yellow.
Push it, 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 push it. Go get the money, go get the money. 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 Push it, push it, push it, push it. Go get the money.